Thanks, Richard. Sorry for jumping in. I'll offer myself as chair unless somebody else wants to do it. Anybody would like to do it rather than me? Okay, I'll assume not then. We'll use the speaking queue. If Adam and Fraser, I'm just going to unmute you. You're server muted. I'm just going to unmute you, but could you please mute yourselves until you're recognized to speak? Adam and Fraser, please mute yourselves, or I'll have to do it again. Fraser, please. I'll thank you. Okay, Howard, please.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks very much. A very interesting exposition indeed. The title of your talk was An Iron Bevan, Man and Myth. We heard a lot about the man and about his ideas and so on. Could you sort of clarify what exactly was or is the myth about Bevan?
Right. Well, I think the myth is that he was a great success, really. I mean, it's the myth is that he was a driving force for change, the man who brought about socialism in Britain. There he is, the dynamic youngest member of of Attlee's cabinet with his fiery speeches. And he really was the mover and shaker, and did all this wonderful stuff, which all Labour members should be proud. That's what I was getting at with the myth, the fact that he's revered, not so much now. Let's say the last 30 years or so, it sort of faded, but I'm reminded more of it in South Wales when my local, almost the nearest pub to me is a Wetherspoons called the Aneurin Bevan. And you've got all these places named after him. His name pops up all over the place. And that's really what I was getting at. It's more, let's say, it's not so much. He is the, you could say it's not the myth of Bevan, but it's the myth of the post-war Labour government, which was, the older members of the Labour Party was in there, would always be banging on about it. I mean, and you'd hear, Barbara Castle would always be talking about how what a the great things we'd done, and that was where the myth comes in.
Can I just say a couple of other things, Richard? Can I just say a couple of other things?
Yes, go ahead, please.
You mentioned, and it's something that a lot of people don't know, and maybe this is part of the myth, that Aneurin Bevan didn't regard the National Health Service as something sort of major. And the fact of the matter is that both parties in the general election in which Labour came to power after the war had in their manifestos the setting up of a National Health Service. So it's not something that was unique to Labour. And as you say, Bevan himself didn't regard it as something sort of unique to him or possibly to Labour either. But the other thing I wanted to say was that you said he became disillusioned with Labour in his later years. Yet, he sort of changed, didn't he? I was reminded when we had a bit of a talk about this a couple of weeks ago when you couldn't get on the platform. And I was reminded of the fact that another thing he's famous for was his speech in which he talks about not going naked into the conference chamber. And by that time, he was talking about, the way capitalism was sort of operating internationally with the possibility of, wars breaking out, et cetera, et cetera. Wars would break out if you didn't have the necessary armaments to sort of, deter your enemy and so on and so forth. I mean, not sort of very socialist, that Labour Party terms of this period.
I was hoping someone would bring that up. Of course, that is a famous part of his speech where he comes out basically supporting the atom bomb, supporting Britain having its deterrence nuclear weapon. I think this was, I think he lost a lot of support amongst the rank and file for this. I'm not quite sure when that speech is. I imagine it's probably about 57. I mean, just before I was born. I'm trying to think when Labour were in favour of unilateral disarmament, I think, in the 1959 general election, and then they were not again until they weren't explicitly in favour of that again until 83. He did change his position. He did mellow, you might say, as he got into his 50s, his 60s. And he did seem to get on better with gate school and trying that. Get the party united, hold out the olive branch and so on. That's interesting. I mean, yeah, obviously he stayed in the Labour Party and he was deputy leader. I'm trying to think what was his last thing he had. He was deputy leader and was he shadow foreign secretary? Yes, he must have been at the time when he was making that speech about not going naked into negotiations. Okay, right.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Comrade Johnson?
Yes. Yeah. To keep on the myth part of Bevan. What I picked up out of the threads I've read about him is that he wasn't the architect of the NHS, like you said, no. That was already put in place for him. Firstly by Beveridge and then by the bureaucrats and the civil service who sorted out the structure, the procedures and the processes involved in the National Health Service. The other thing is as well, he met quite a bit, although not much opposition of the Tories, or the Liberals, well, the Liberals welcomed it as well. But he met opposition from the doctors, both the surgeons and the GPs, and like members of the working class, which they are, right, they were concerned about recompensation. What would the wages be in the NHS? And Evan knew what the economics of it was all, what it was all about, and he knew that there'd have to be a wage cut as far as the doctors were concerned. But he had to concede to them because what they did is turned out and said, right, well, if that's the case, we wouldn't join the NHS, right? We would remain private, both in our practices general practices and also as soldiers as well. And he had to turn around and concede their demands in regards to their salary levels, etc. He didn't have it all his own way. It wasn't an easy run. So, but today, you know, his legacy is with us, as we find out with the doctor's services now, that the doctors are not entering the NHS as much as all governments would like. Both GPs practices very low on recruitment, and soldiers as well are low on the horizon. And that's simply because there's more money to be had elsewhere. A lot of the medical staff and trainees are off to either to the States, Canada, or Australia, where they get far more to get over here.
Do you want to come back on that, Richard? Or can I put my question to you?
Just briefly, I'll say yes. I agree with what Brian said. There's no doubting that. That's the fact. I mean, there was huge resistance from the professionals, say the doctors and the surgeons, to the NHS, because it was like an attack on their professionalism. They didn't like the idea of being an employee and that, you know, what they would get paid. And what's happened largely, I think, over the, you know, this is two generations ago, over that time, the BMA have become supporters of the health service because they've made it work to their advantage. And it's true about, you know, you get a lot of the training goes on of all sorts of medical staff in the health service. You know, you have the teaching hospitals. Once people are qualified, they find, you know, they just... they're struggling to live on what the pay that they get. And, yes, they'll go abroad and they'll go into the private sector. And there's very little that the government can do about that. But that was, yeah, that's... and the other things that Brian said is, yeah, that's... I did read about this, and it's all true. I mean, Bevan was just, he was in charge. He wasn't making most of the decisions. All the hard work was done by the civil servants and various others who did all the grunt work, as is normally the case in these things.
Okay, thanks. If I can put my point, as there's nobody else in the queue anyway, I was interested to hear what you said early on in your talk about the Conservative Party was also put forward a National Health Service at the time in 1945. I didn't know that, and the reason I'm interested in it at the moment is that tomorrow, for example, there's a demonstration in Manchester by a group called People's Assembly, and they want to protect the NHS, and it's the Labour Party, and they are going to, you know, they put themselves forward as the party of the National Health Service. Well, we've not got any current document. We've not got current leaflets or anything at the moment that we could use at this type of demonstration. But we're going leafleting tomorrow with some general leaflets. But it'd be really interesting if you could. I'm sorry to suggest some work for somebody else. But it'd be really interesting if you could capture some of this stuff that you've been talking about tonight, Richard, not specifically about Bevin, but about the Labour Party and about how they are not the defenders of the national health that they purport to be. All right, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, as far as health is concerned, I think going in the 90s, Conservatives brought in this market, you know, the internal market in the health service. And there were those in Labour who wanted to scrap it. But that didn't really happen. And there's, you know, various things where the parties are very much, Labour and the Tories have done very much the same thing. I think it's quite well documented. It'd be good to go back, actually, need to see what, find out what was in the Conservative Party's manifesto in 1945. But certainly there, that's the point, is that all parties were agreed on they were going to do something based on the Beveridge report to build on health provisions. Because Churchill, when he was in the Liberal Party in the, what is it, the People's Budget of 1909, the National Insurance Act, he and Lloyd George did this sort of first phase, really, of a welfare state with national insurance and providing benefits for both health and unemployment. I'm not quite sure of the details now, but I mean, that's all part of the Labour myth, which, you know, I've bought into myself for a while, that it's that holy of, you know, no one has touched the NHS, it's ours. There's a lot of nonsense talked about it. But it's interesting that any radical changes never seem to get very far. Someone I knew at university, he was, when I was at Exeter in the late 70s, a guy who became president of the Guild of Students, one Andrew Lansley, who I thought, when the SDP was found, I thought Lansley, that would suit him down to the ground. But in fact, he joined the Conservative Party and he got one of the safest Tory seats in the country in South Cambridgeshire. And then he became Secretary of State for Health in 2010. And he came up with some very radical plans, which basically amounted to partial privatisation of the NHS, and Cameron basically distanced himself for this, and they got dropped, they got pushed to one side. Jeremy Hunt took over as Health Secretary. I see Adam has just put something on the speaking queue concerning the National Health Service, so that... that should make good reading. This might be just what you want, Steve. And I'll take a look at that later. Thanks, Alan.
Okay, thanks. okay, we'll take Howard again. Thanks, Howard.
Sorry, Richard, is it just what we want? Because I notice it's articles from the Standard in 1944. So, I mean, I fancy Adam doesn't want to speak because there's something wrong with his with his connection. Maybe wrong about that, but I think that may be the case. If he is able to speak, then he's in the speaking queue there. Perhaps he can sort of tell us something about that article or those articles, which, if I understand correctly, are pre-National Health Service.
Go on then, Adam. Yeah. Please.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Well, what? I mean, it is relevant because it's an article from 1944. It's a white paper by the coalition government at the time, which was Tory, Labour, and Liberal. So they were talking about a National Health Service. You know, the previous government to the Attlee government, and I think the emphasis is on national because there were health services before that, but they didn't cover everybody. So this was a white paper. I haven't reread it for a long time, but it's showing that the idea of a National Health Service was accepted by all the parties in the in the wartime coalition, including the Tories. So I think it is. I thought it was relevant to the point that was being made. The question that was being asked by Steve.
Yeah, my point, Adam, is that we could do with something current to deal with the labour rights of the type of demonstration I'm going to tomorrow. Anyway, okay. I mean, I'm sure that will feed into it. I'm sure.
Personally, I mean, I think the NHS is great. The UK were like trailblazers with it, not entirely trailblazers, I don't know, because I think Sweden had already been doing something. Sweden had this social democrat government. They won every election for over 40 years, I think starting in the 30s. And they have something very similar to our NHS. Other more advanced capitalist nations have sort of overtaken us in one way or another. All variations on a theme and that you might have to pay for some treatment, but then you can claim it back. They do that in France. Anecdotal evidence of people I know in both France and Italy have been amazed how good the health service is compared to where they were living in the UK. You know, it doesn't matter what the problem is, they don't seem to have the waiting lists and anything mediocre about the services provided. What was I going to say? It comes back to our position on reforms. It's always a bit complicated, this, because we're not against reforms. That would be crazy, you know. Anything that improves the life or the vast majority of people, you know, anything that is definitely good for the working class, we support it. And our point is we don't go out and campaign for these things. We don't have a program of reforms because we realise the limitations of reforms within capitalism, isn't it? It's the fact that it's not on the road to socialism. And that's one of those, it's all part of the mirage, all part of the fooling yourself, which I did for a long time, over 20 years in the Labour Party, that you sell people these ideas and then you can persuade them to this bigger, greater thing that you're on the road, you know, the British road to socialism. That's the Communist Party. what was, but it's very similar policies to Labour. But, you know, you're going in the right direction. Well, you're not going in any direction really at all. You're going around in circles. But you wouldn't. We're not going to go out on the street and say no to the health service, and we wouldn't say no to higher wages. You're not saying no to the vote, things like that. But we're just saying we want socialism as an immediate aim, and this is the way. Once we have that, then we can really get to grips and solve all the problems. You know, we have I shouldn't say a miracle cure. You know what I mean? That so many of the things that people are proposing as reforms are things that are necessary within capitalism. It's like people who spend their whole time working on taxes, that tax is the big issue. We need to reform the tax system. You know, you have a tax justice organisation. And I think this is really what matters. But, you know, we'll just scrap taxes altogether, won't we? We'll scrap the state. We'll get rid of money. Job done. Anyway, I'm wandering off a bit there, but I just thought it was a sort of relevant thing to say.
Yes, it was, Richard. Has anybody got any questions or points they'd like to raise around Richard's talk? Or failing that, is there anything else that people would like to bring into the discussion? Okay, take Adam.
The thing about the British or National Health Service, there are two things. One is you can have a national health service, in other words, a service which covers everybody. You know, on some of the continental countries, like France, each particular group of workers has got their own sick pay scheme. So, I mean, and in fact, if they tried to introduce a national health service, some workers would be worse off. And in fact, some workers, I think, were worse off when the national health service was introduced in Britain. But I think that the feature of the British scheme, and the one which justifies the word socialism, in inverted commas, is that it's free. It's free at the time of use, which isn't the case as Richard was saying. In many other countries, when I was working on the continent, the scheme I was in is you paid, and then you could claim 80 or 90% back. I mean, which of course involves a huge, bureaucracy to manage it. You can have a national health service which isn't free, and I think, as I say, the advantage from a working class point of view, I think, it is the fact that in Britain it is free to people. When they need it, but that isn't the case in other countries. In fact, I'm not sure when it was set up, it wasn't supposed to be an insurance scheme. I mean, the national insurance contributions are going up today. Was it next week? They were partly paid, but of course, it's only a notional thing. Most of the National Health Service is paid by out of the general government subsidy. But I wanted to make that point. You know, you can distinguish between a national health service and a free health service. And I think it's both of them might be advantageous from a working class point of view within capitalism. But I think it's the free element it's a free element that does distinguish it. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I'll take Howard next, and then I'll ask Richard if he wants to come back in. Howard, please.
Richard is sort of praising the National Health Service, and I know what he means. It's, you know, it's a good thing to be able to have medical care more or less when you need it. Doesn't always work out that well, but nevertheless, you know, it's there, it's available. But probably worth reminding people that in its literature traditionally, the party has referred to the National Health Service as a cheap back-to-work service. And that's the sort of the attitude the party has, really. Not that the National Health Service was brought in to benefit workers, but that it was brought in to benefit capitalism, to get people back to work, people who might be sick, to get them back to work quickly and to produce so that the owners of capital might continue to realise profit. So I think we've got to bear that in, you know, that's what really should be at the forefront of our minds when we're looking at a lot of reforms. A lot of reforms might be beneficial to works, but very often this is just incidental. They're not there necessarily to be beneficial to workers. That's a sort of side effect. They're, well, I wouldn't say always, but very many times there to help capitalism run more smoothly. And okay, if workers benefit as a side effect, all well and good, and therefore we're not going to oppose that. But you know, we've got to sort of look beneath the motive for them, rather than sort of, you know, welcome them as a good thing because, you know, a kind government has brought them in or something like that. I also wanted to say a brief word about the Labour Party in Wales. It's a strange phenomenon, isn't it? I mean, I'm somebody who's lived in Wales for very many years, but wasn't born and brought up here. And I can't help to be continually struck and somewhat amazed, really, by the Welsh attachment to Labour. Okay, it comes and goes a little bit, but nevertheless, it doesn't take much for a reversion to the sort of default position that Wales elects Labour candidates in elections, both local and national, consistently, even when in the rest of the UK different things are happening. Quite remarkable, really. There's this sort of almost inbuilt attachment to Labour, associated perhaps with the early working class history in Wales, when the Labour Party sort of presented itself as the party of the workers. It's still there anyway, to a much greater extent than anywhere else in Wales, anywhere else in Britain. Certainly, somewhere like Scotland, where completely different things have happened.
Do you want to say something about that, Richard?
Yes, I will, actually. I haven't lived in Wales as long as Howard. It's got about a 30-year start on me, I think. But it is quite noticeable and strange, having come from somewhere, going from a place where things are more volatile. I spent most of my life in Hertfordshire, where I lived in a constituency which was conservative most of the time, the sort of neighbouring one in St Albans sort of would swing back and forth. And Hertfordshire as a whole, as a county, the county council would often be no overall control, or it could be Labour, or it could be Conservative. And there's more of a, let's say the voters are more fickle. They're more of the floating voter, which in South Wales, they're just lots of, many parts of South Wales in particular, that just isn't the case. It would take a major it would be seen as a disaster for Labour to lose seats in the valleys in particular. And I would have said, only not, you know, if you roll back to maybe about 15 years ago, you would have said the same about Scotland, that they were completely committed, and largely for the same reason. The industrial or post-industrial areas of Scotland, voting Labour tradition carries on. It's connected to trade union organisation and the sort of industry that's there. And so that's, you see quite a sudden drop off in Labour's fortunes in Scotland. So it could happen in Wales as well. I know there's people I've worked with, one chap in particular, who the thought of voting for anyone else was completely, anyone but Labour. Well, he'd just never do it. He's always voted Labour, even though this is when, Taunton went after Jeremy Corbyn had become leader. He hadn't got much time for Corbyn at all. But he would never go as far as voting for anyone else. So interesting to know, he'd actually left the office, and I don't know what he did in the 2017 general election, whether he just didn't vote. But, that's it. I mean, there was a bit of a herd instinct amongst voters. And to some extent, not really thinking about it, not thinking about it too deeply, rather like supporting your football teams. And I found that in my days in Labour, when you go out canvassing, you felt those who automatically said yes, I think, well, actually, if I actually thought about it a bit more deeply, we might lose their vote. You know? So there are people we didn't want to get into much of a debate with because you were afraid that you might put them off. If you said, well, oh, that's good, because I want to do, when I'm on the council, I want to do ABC. What's wrong about that? It's very interesting. I think with Labour as a whole, the fact that it is such a coalition of parties and how it and different organisations that manage to come together as one, and some of those wounds. I mean, some of these divisions become clearer at certain times, like the unions versus the constituency, the rank and file between the other organisations like the co-ops and various affiliated societies. You know, at conference time, how things would chop and change. But it is surprising. Yeah, it is surprising about Wales because so much of the sort of power base, you think, for Labour has not so much gone as it's become diffuse because, you know, people are, there's far less trade union membership, there's all sorts of different jobs, there's been immigration, lots of, you know, vast changes in the structure of the economy and people's attitudes in the later generation, their social attitudes, on a whole number of things which you might think would cause them to be more volatile in how they vote. But it's true that there's still this, like, very, very solid Labour block I think it's interesting that in the Welsh Assembly, because of the voting system, it ensures that though Labour has the most seats, they actually have a majority, which is a good thing, really, because they could just be once or this is when. As I say, you're more likely to get more corruption and nepotism and complacency sort of takes hold. And it's never a good thing. You always want to have strong opposition and to keep their people who are supposed to be representing you on their toes.
Okay, thanks, Richard. We've nobody in the queue for the moment. Adam, go ahead, please.
Yeah, well, I'm in the opposite situation from Howard and Richard, because I was born and brought up in Wales, but haven't lived there for about 50 years. But I've still got brothers who are living there, and I still visit it from time to time and follow what's going on there. But I think the thing about until about the 60s and 70s, the mining valleys were one party state. The Labour Party controlled the council sometimes with 100% people. In fact, people were afraid to say that they were Conservatives. I mean, when Bevan made his famous remark about Tories being lower than vermin, he was probably expressing a widespread opinion of people in the mining valleys as a result of their experiences in the 1920s and 1930s. But I mean, as Richard had just pointed out, if you have a one-party state, what develops is corruption and nepotism, and what the people that voted against that. They didn't turn to the Tory party. They turned to the Welsh Nationalist Party, Plaid Cymru. And in fact, the only time that I think Labour has lost seats in the mining valleys has been to Plaid, which incidentally, I don't know whether it still does, but it also claimed to be a socialist party. So, but I don't think that in Wales, the Welsh Nationalist Party will make the same breakthrough as it did as it has done in Scotland. Well, partly because its main strength is Welsh speakers, and people that haven't spoken Welsh in the Western mining valleys for generations. I mean, my grandparents spoke Welsh, but only so that their children couldn't understand what they were talking about. So I don't think Plaid Cymru is going to sweep the board in Wales. And in some parts of Wales are completely anglicised. I'm surprised to find that parts of, I don't know what they're called now, Radnorshire and so on in mid Wales and near the English border. They had UKIP mayors and things like that, and so I don't. But I don't think the Tories will ever come back in Wales. Maybe they will to some extent. But they get some odd people as their candidates, like the one in Bridgend, which I'm sure Labour's going to win back at the next election.
Any more comrades? Oh, sorry, Richard, did you want to come in?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm not sure what the Bridgend MP's majority is, but it's quite small. That was a 2019 gain for the Tories. Yes, I think what Adam said is largely true. I mean, see, the situation is in Scotland, we haven't got anyone from the Glasgow area on tonight, I don't think, but I'm sure they'd say that Glasgow in particular, in the, well, probably in the 80s, certainly prior to that, where there's such a massive solid vote for Labour, that there'd be the same issues of corruption, nepotism, and not wanting, even if it's a secret ballot, but you're not going to tell your neighbour that you didn't vote, that you voted Tory or didn't vote Labour anyway. But things did move away, but probably the language is a factor. Plaid Cymru, the Welsh nationalists have tried to become more, they've tried to become more general and less Welsh, you know, I feel, recent. I don't follow them very much, but I get the feeling, especially the new leader, somebody Price, is he Adam Price, I think, who is quite sort of as if he's trying to steal the Lib Dem vote, certainly, and some of the Tory vote, since he seems to be more concentrating on. I thought the previous leader, Leanne Woods, who was more left-wing, I think, you got the impression they were eyeing up the Labour vote. Anyway, do we really want to get deep into capitalist politics? I don't know. It's just, it's always strange to look at some of these loyalties, how they arrive. And they can, of course, change rapidly. And with our electoral system, there can be some sort of turning point. I was thinking about with what happened to the Liberals in the early 20th century, the time during Bevan's lifetime, and what I was just discussing, where the Liberals just dropped below this threshold where you would win many seats, and I think they got down to 2 MPs at one time, and then it's years and years before their share of the vote built up enough for them to come up to a reasonable level. And what lousy negotiators they have been, you know, with Nick Clegg, when they had the opportunity to, they had a chance of power, and they blew it in not saying, well, yeah, we'll work with you, but you're going to have to bring in proportional representation. They could really go for that. They had this, just had a referendum on the alternate votes. Okay, wandering off to other things. I meant to say, actually, Adam, agreed with you about the health service, in that I'm not sure if there's any country that has a health service like us, possibly in Sweden, where it is free at the point of delivery. That is the essential difference. And it's a universal health system. And, you know, and, well, like 90% free. I mean, in Wales, no one pays any prescription charges. It's devolution. In England, you do, and various things you have to pay for. I mean, dentistry is bizarre, seems to cost so much. It seems to be not fully integrated into the NHS. But, yeah, it is close to a sort of socialist principle. But I also agree with Howard that, yes, the reason it's there is to keep capitalism going. We are fixing workers so they can go, fixing people up so they can go back to work and make profits and be useful. And we see that over and over again, that the old and the, or the chronically sick, are a low priority in the system. because you know they're not out there, and they're not going to produce anything. So they're second class citizens. Right.
Okay. Thanks, Richard.
I'll stop there. Okay. Right.
Well, I've got Howard in, but just as a point of interest, some of the comrades in the Yorkshire Discussion Group are currently preparing something on social care and how that's going on. Just one point, I've got experience with the health services in Uruguay and Argentina, and in both those countries, you've got emergency care, which is free at the point of delivery, but of course it's so poorly funded that anybody that's got any money whatsoever has got private health insurance. We got Howard. And I think after that, if the meeting's in agreement, after Howard's made his contribution, I'll wrap up. I'll invite Richard to wrap up. And Howard, please.
Right, just one final thing, which doesn't sort of relate specifically to what we've been talking about, i.e., Nairin Bevan and associating matters, but. And it's something that Joy has asked me to sort of mention to you, and perhaps it's something that will send us off on a sort of positive note. Some of you may remember that last year the BBC Radio 4 ran a series of programmes called Rethink, in which they asked people to write expressing ideas about how we should rethink things after the contagion, after COVID. And I think we talked about this at the time, that Joy wrote to say that, and I've got this, it's a brief message here. She wrote something like, every problem regarding children, parents, teachers, and education in general, because it was a program about how we should rethink education, boiled down to one thing: poverty, lack of funding, and scarcity. I suggest there could be a solution to this worldwide situation: a moneyless society, a society of free access where goods and services are provided for the benefit of mankind and not for profit. I would suggest that this is a fascinating topic for discussion. It is not a new idea. The Socialist Party has been disseminating this idea for over 100 years. Now, the response to that was, I suppose, what you might call radio silence. Not a word, not mentioned anywhere on the radio or any kind of response. However, now, magically, about what, 9 months later, Joy has had a personal response from the presenter of the program, Amal Rajan. Some of you may know him. He presents lots of things now on radio and I think television as well. And his response says the following: "Dear Joy, huge and belated thanks for your message. I'm sorry for the delay in responding. I probably haven't given your idea sufficient reflection, but I will start to think about it now. Thank you for putting the thought in my mind, Amal." So there we are. Somebody in some kind of prominent position has heard the idea. Will anything come of it as a result? Is it worth now pursuing with him in other areas? I don't know. But anyway, I thought it's Joy thought it was something that you might want to hear about.
Thank you. Thank you, Joy, as well. That's really interesting news. Richard, do you want to sum up? It's 9 o'clock. If you've anything new you want to say, or just dismiss everybody.
Well, I just want to say that's very good news. That's very promising. This response to what Joy sent in. So yeah, that is ending on a high note, really.
Okay.
Okay. That's about it.
Okay, then with the meeting's permission, I'll thank on their behalf Richard for his talk, and thank you all for coming. And we'll speak to you all soon. Thank you. and good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Richard. Bye. Bye, all.
Bye.
Thank you, Richard. Bye.